Pač. Pač nek tak. Pač nek tak. RS intervju.
Kokoši zarodki v raziskavah otroškega raka. Vsakič, ko se celice delijo, se poveča verjetnost, da gre kaj narobe. Nekatere napake lahko povzročijo, da se celice pričnejo nenadzorovano deliti, čemur pravimo rak. Rak se običajno pojavlja pri starejših ljudeh, zato je še vedno uganka, kako lahko kljub temu za njim zbolijo tudi otroci. O otroškem raku smo se pogovarjali z doktorico Sophie Molin, raziskovalko na Univerzi v Lundu. Sophie Molin raziskuje nevroblastom, otroški rak simpatičnega živčevja, ki se običajno razvija v nadledvični žlezi in ga diagnosticirajo pri otrocih do 5. leta starosti.
Could you tell me a bit about what is neuroblastoma, the cancer that you're researching in your group?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a rare childhood tumor. It's the most common tumor for of infancy, which means that it's young children between birth and 1 year of age. And in Sweden, it's about 20 children a year, 15 to 20 children. So it's not that many, but still it's very aggressive. Most children get their diagnosis between or before the age of 5. So it's very young children, and some patients are born with their tumor. That's not very common, or at least they are diagnosed. I would guess that most patients are born with their tumor, but we don't detect them until later. But for some children, we do detect them at birth. So we know that something happens already during embryogenesis or fetal development. And about half of the tumors, more or less, are very aggressive, which means that they are very difficult to cure.
So I was wondering, since you were talking about the development, you work with the development of neuroblastoma, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the initiation.
Yeah.
And so I was caught when I did my PhD. That was also on neuroblastoma, but a completely different part of tumorigenesis. And then I just got really hooked by understanding how a tumor can develop that early. Because if you look at cancer in general, I mean, we do understand most cancers are sporadic, or that you're unlucky, to be frank. And in humans, that, or humans, in adults, that makes sense, because you have cell divisions, you know, and mutations occurring and so on. It comes with age. But for children, they don't really have the wrong environment. They haven't gone through that many cell divisions. Doesn't really make sense that children get cancer, and especially not when they're that young. So that sort of caught my attention. And there's so many similarities between neuroblastoma already back then. This is, I mean, over 10 years ago. There were so many similarities still between neuroblastoma and early fetal development, but the connection was not as clear. And I would say maybe in 2017, around 15, 17, 18, there were more papers coming in, especially during early 2020s. Papers came that really sort of founded the connection between neuroblastoma and fetal development. But I was caught by it, and I really want to understand that, because still, I mean, even though the connection itself is established and it's now clear, and everybody believes that neuroblastoma do arise during embryogenesis and from this specific cell population that is called neural crest. But especially back then, and still, we don't really know when that happens, and especially not why. And neural crest is very diverse cell population. Is extremely sort of, in my sense, cool. because it's really, it's highly multipotent. So it gives rise to so many different cell types. So in one way, it makes sense that if something goes wrong in this really specific population that is so essential during development, that something happens like cancer. But on the other hand, it's also so contained that very rarely something occurs that you know, is this sort of bad? Because then it's too fatal for the cell so that they would actually die. So that's sort of the reason. So that's why I look at that part. I really want to understand why this tumor initiates so early. It really, I mean, it's really, really different to any other tumor or most other tumors.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of like digged into to my next question that was about cancer being associated with old age.
Yeah.
So for neuroblastoma, that is different.
Yes.
But does it have any risk factors?
I mean, most childhood cancers in general are not inherited. And the reason for that is very often because children get really harsh treatments. Chemotherapy, for example, they get in higher doses than adults. Basically, we do everything we can to cure a child, which makes a lot of sense, right? But the treatment is really harsh. And with today's treatments, like chemotherapy, radiation, I mean, we do cure many patients. About 70% in total of neuroblastoma patients are cured. But it comes with a price that we often tend to forget as scientists specifically. You know, we are so focused on curing, which is the first step, of course. But we tend to forget about the life that they will have afterwards, which maybe I'm getting out of topic here, but which often leads to infertility, which means that children who survive their cancer cannot have children on their own. So there are quite a few. Or only a few cases of inherited cancer. In neuroblastoma, it's about 2%, so it's very few. So that means that the remaining 98-ish percent are actually then sporadic. So it has been studies, of course, of what kind of environmental factors there is. The problem with us is what you have to do is look at the woman, the pregnant woman. So what kind of environment is she in? And that is difficult because there are so many parameters. You can look at country, but what does that say? Is it genetics? Is it, you know, what kind of environment? And there hasn't, in my opinion, there are studies that has shown a few relationships maybe, or that it's correlations. But in my opinion, there's definitely no studies that have proven any sort of factor or a very specific thing that would cause neuroblastoma. And there has been, for example, screening programs in Japan. They only discovered very, very benign tumors. So they discovered a lot of more tumors or neuroblastomas, but only the benign ones that would more or less disappear by themselves if we hadn't discovered them, or we, but these researchers. So I think there are very few factors. And if you talk about how you get cancer with environmental factors involved, is of course there are some very obvious ones, which is of course smoking or a very high exposure to the sun. I mean, that's established, very established, right? And I think that's important, but always when I give popular science seminars, because then of course you talk about why you get cancer, I do talk about lifestyle, but I think it's really exaggerated, because what you hear in media is there are correlations between cancer, definitely between cancer and, for example, obesity or, you know, an unhealthy lifestyle. Or like, you know, you can see this, oh, you get cancer from eating rice, or you get cancer from drinking soda or Coke. And I would say that that's a correlation for sure, but that has not to do with that you get cancer from these different choices of life, so to say. And I think that we scare people way too easily. And I always say at those seminars that you should live healthy, which does not mean that you have to be super thin or, you know, exercise twice a day, but you should live in a healthy way for, you know, because it's good for you in general, and especially for like heart disease, right? That's way more common from these factors than cancer. And I think people, sometimes we sort of blame people who get cancer because, you know, oh, you can get cancer from your health, you know, from your lifestyle. And of course, you can always, you know, if you have a more healthy lifestyle, you probably prevent more diseases, or you can avoid some diseases. But I think it's really important to talk about when it comes to cancer, this very, except for smoking and really high exposure to sun, I would say that it's very few cases that are really, you know, born out of a bad lifestyle.
And not the same goes for neuroblastoma. So there's no risk factors that you would say?
No, no. So the pregnant woman cannot do anything to decrease the risk of neuroblastoma.
Mm.
And that's also something I think is really important, because especially with childhood cancers and these really early ones, it's easy for parents to blame themselves. Could we have done anything different? But here, no, they couldn't.
But how is studying pediatric cancers different from adult cancers in practice?
But I think because the fetus is protected while, you know, during pregnancy, right? That the fetus will not be exposed to the sun, for example. Of course, smoking might have, like, because of a secondary effect, but it hasn't really been shown that neuroblastoma can be...
It's fine. It shows that we're in a lab environment.
Yeah.
There's always stuff happening in the background.
No, but the fetus itself is so, protected in the womb from external factors in many ways, because it hasn't really been shown, as I said, that whatever the woman does would affect or cause cancer, cause neuroblastoma. And when the child is born, and maybe, first of all, I do think that every neuroblastoma is initiated during embryogenesis. But with that said, that not all of them are tumors. But I do think that something happens during embryogenesis in every case of neuroblastoma. This is my hypothesis. Which means that even in the sense of whatever environment that the child is exposed to after birth, who knows, maybe it could increase the risk of, you know, if a virus or something. I don't think so. I think there are other factors, and it's already predetermined, sort of, because these events have already happened. And it might be a second genetic event, for example, which is then just really unlucky. You are prime, but you get a second hit of something, for example. But that is, I mean, it's a huge difference to adult cancers. And if we look at adult cancers between the age of maybe 30 and 50, it's almost always inherited cancer. Not always, but to a very large extent. And otherwise, you get sporadic cancers after 60, maybe. And I mean, by then, you've had so many cell divisions. By every day, we have that risk increasing. And in many cases, I tend to use the word unlucky, and I know that's very debated if you can do that or not. We can say sporadic, but I do think that is often the case, that you will never know. And that, of course, is then a huge difference to a child when something really occurs that is of absolutely essential during development, whereas in an adult, it's basically a mutation or another genetic hit or loss of a chromosome or a chromosomal aberration that happens during a cell division or for some other reason.
Yeah, some people like to compare it to lottery tickets.
I think that's good.
Yeah.
A good comparison.
It's kind of the opposite.
I was going to say, yeah.
But I would say it's like lottery tickets. Every time a cell divides, you basically get a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
And every time you smoke, you take a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
And then it's the bigger chance.
Yeah. And I mean, I usually say that as well in doing a lecture, but I mean, you get in every, I think it's, let's just say, 100,000. It's a really hard word, a difficult word in English. Nucleotide, there is something happening during cell division. And, you know, it doesn't sound a lot, but considering that we have 6 billion nucleotides, that are quite a lot of things happening during each cell division. And I mean, as we know, and that I tend to, or like to tell, is that a cell can repair 99% of those faults, which is amazing, and just that, you know, cell biology is pretty amazing, but that still means that 1% remains, and that is the lottery ticket, right? That 1% remains, and if you're lucky, then this it's either something that doesn't matter, the cell can still continue as, you know, as normal, or it actually programs itself to die But then you do have, so, you know, we have so many levels of protection, but there is this very last part, which if you are unlucky and you get the opposite to the biggest lottery win, you can get cancer.
Mm. Okay, so back to neuroblastoma specifically. Some researchers joke about the fact that there are more neuroblastoma yeah. researchers than patients. So do you think that the neuroblastoma field is, because of that, lagging behind some of the more common cancers like colorectal cancer or breast cancer?
And definitely in Sweden, there's a joke about that, and it's true, right? Because there are 15, 20 children a year who get cancer, and we are way many more researchers on neuroblastoma. But I think most neuroblastoma researchers also do other cancer forms, for example. I study also paraganglioma and pheochromocytoma, which are also cancers that very few people have even heard of. They are adult cancers, but they share the developmental origin with neuroblastoma. So that's my interest in actually looking at all of these. And I know, for example, many other researchers who do neuroblastoma, they also do medulloblastoma and other childhood cancers that are similar. So first of all, I think that we, and today we know so much about these tumors, and we know that they are different, very different, but there are also commonalities, or we have methods that can be used to study several cancers. And that we did not have, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago. But today we have so many new technologies with how we culture cells, with sequencing and so on, that we can actually use our knowledge for a wider spectra than just in you know, quotation marks, that it's just neuroblastoma. I think we're not lagging behind because of that, because I do think we use our knowledge way broader and wiser today. And I think so because we also collaborate more. We are more people working on it, but we also, in my opinion and what I've noticed since I started, I mean, I did my first lab internship in 2007 when I was still studying. And since then, the development of the field, and I wouldn't say that people were more hesitant to collaborate back then, but there weren't as many, you didn't have the techniques, you didn't have the same easy way to communicate. I mean, we did go on conference, of course, and that had happened before I started, but it wasn't the same. Today, I feel that we are way more open to collaborations. We understand that we need to collaborate because of all the models we have. There are so many models we can use, and we all have different models and expertise. The technology has moved forward so much in these last, just say, 5 years. It's amazing, right? And we cannot do all of it. So I think we're not lagging behind because we are many. So maybe even the opposite, because now we are many people that do research on this tumor, but we gather our expertise also from other fields or other tumor forms. And I mean, you can do tumor immunology, or you can do, I mean, it's not only neuroblastoma and all of neuroblastoma, but you actually sort of specify, I mean, my special field in that sense is the developmental part, right? I've become, during my postdoc, I also sort of became a developmental biologist because I learned that field. So I can contribute with that, whereas many others can contribute with other parts. So I think being more researchers within the field is for good. It's a good thing. And I feel that the field itself has moved forward in acknowledging each other and understanding how much that we can do together.
Okay, so you were mentioning more about now, like, the developmental aspects that you're studying with cancer development. So I think it's very interesting that you use chicken embryos for your research. How does that work?
Yeah, I like it too. I think it's interesting too. So when I did my PhD, as I mentioned before, I can't remember exactly how, but I really had this moment, sort of to generalize, but I had this moment like, this is what I want to do. Like, I want to understand the developmental aspect. So then I asked myself, well, if I want to do that, how? What is the best way to do it? And I could use mice. I did use mice for, I mean, not developmental aspects, but other aspects during my PhD. And but I kind of felt that for developmental biology, mice are not the optimal. That's not the optimal model. I think zebrafish can be really good as well. But I was looking into, and I've heard this professor, Marianne Bronner, at a conference, and I read her a little bit of her work, and I just admired her a lot as a scientist, as a strong woman. Now she's almost turning 70, I think. So, I mean, she's she's very senior. And she was using the chicken embryo and for neural crest studies, and it's just perfect. It's obviously not a perfect model, but to study neural crest, it's a really, really good model. So at that point, I felt that for me, that would be the best model. Zebrafish was not established in, well, chicken embryo was not established in Lund either, but it was a different thing. And mice, I wanted to move away from that if I could. So I just, you know, I realized that the chicken embryo would be perfect for what I wanted to study.
But why would it be perfect?
Because first, I mean, the neural crest development, which is what I needed and wanted to look at, because that is the population of cells where neuroblastoma derives from or arises. And Marianne had shown for so many years how much data you could get or how much information you could get if you use a chick embryo to do these studies. And not many people at that time, no one basically had used it for neuroblastoma, the chicken embryo. But I saw that, you know, if we use it for the things that Marianne and her group had been using it for years, we could extract that and move it forward to cancer. And Marianne has had an interest in it, but they haven't really looked at it in that way. And so it's not that no one had thought about that it could be used. It just has not been used for neuroblastoma before. And it's really accessible. You can have it in the lab. So especially I can tell you all of the advantages that I felt when I came back here, how good it is. But at that point, I just thought that it's an accessible model that can really answer more easily the questions I had than other models. And I really liked Marianne, so I thought it would be fantastic to go to her lab.
So is chicken embryo a common model organism otherwise in cancer research, or maybe generally in research? What do people normally use it for?
Yeah, so I think it's used, now it's a little bit more used for cancer research. Definitely not very much still. And I think there's two ways that you can use, and let's say the egg. So I use mostly the embryo. Right? That 90% of the research. But what you can do is also utilize the blood, the vascular system in the egg. And that, of course, goes into the embryo, but you have this beautiful blood network surrounding the embryo. So that's what is supplying the embryo all the oxygen and nutrients, because obviously there's no placenta. So you can, for example, put tumor cells on top of that and they will grow, which is basically what you do when you inject into a mouse, right? You inject tumor cells and they grow, and you can measure the growth. You can do that here as well. So that has become more, it's called the CAM assay, chorioallantoic membrane assay. And that's been more and more used, I would say, because it's also easy. One of the best aspects, or, you know, biggest advantages is that, I mean, we have them just here outside of my office, right? We have them on the lab bench here, so it's so accessible. We buy commercially fertilized eggs, so it's very easy. The embryos that I use mostly, or we, my group uses mostly, is not very common to use for cancer research still. It's becoming, again, a bit like a few groups at least that use it, but not very much at all. And especially not for neuroblastoma before I started. I mean, I started to set it up in Lund in 2017. That's, you know, slowly starting. I had like 300 eggs that year, but I was slowly setting it up. And by then it was not common at all. It was used in Umeå for other developmental biology studies. And it had been used for a limited time in Stockholm at Karolinska, but not anymore at that time. So they stopped. So very uncommon. For developmental biology, it's much more used because of its accessibility, right? So instead of mice or zebrafish, the chick embryo has been used. And then especially for neural crest, as I said, it's really similar. And I would say that you can use mice as well for neural crest development compared to human. But the chick embryo, it sounds crazy, but if you look at the embryo, and you see directly a mouse embryo is different. But if you look at the chick embryo and human embryo, up to a certain developmental time point, of course, but quite far, you cannot see a difference between the human embryo and the chick embryo. We look exactly the same. And the development of the neural crest is extremely similar, which sounds crazy. And of course, at some point, we start to differ a lot. But there are similarities between chick and human that is not shared with mice, for example. So for developmental biology studies, it has been quite common. Chick and then quail, which is it's not a smaller version of chicken, but it's very similar, that have been used for example, transplantation studies, and you can actually see how neural crest develops. So for that part of science, it's been used since the 80s or maybe even before 70s. But it has sort of been contained to that research area.
Would you say that there are also some limitations to the model? I mean,
exactly. That's also, I mean, every model has its limitations. And I mean, of course, if you want to understand human disease, you would use human embryos. But we can't do that because we can't grow embryos in the lab. And then there are pros and cons with all other models. I mean, the biggest disadvantage with or limitation with the chick is, of course, that it is not a human, right? And it has no placenta. So it develops outside of, you know, it's outside of the how do you say that when it's animal, you know, but the hen. So of course, it's a different way of development than the human. So that we have to take into account. But what I like with the chick embryo is that it's still in its natural environment. So that's an advantage that we still have the contained environment. After a certain time point, of course, we start to differ in organogenesis. So that's a limitation, of course. And at the very, very early stages, then with the extraembryonic membranes and so on, we don't have that, or the chick embryo doesn't have that as the human has. But and other limitations, but that goes more for us as individuals when doing research on chicken embryos, is of course that it's less studied, so there's less material, so we have to optimize much more than if what you do if you have human cell cultures or even mice, because it's so common. So it's a little bit more work sometimes. It's definitely, in my sense, or in my opinion, it's definitely, you know, that disadvantage is made up by how easy it is to access and use than in the lab. But I mean, the biggest disadvantage or limitation, of course, it's that it's not human, right? And in some aspects, we are very different.
Would you mention any interesting discoveries that you made this model?
Yeah, I think one of the, in my group, we focus very much on two different proteins that we know are important. And I think one of the, so far we published last year that I'm very proud of that work. We identified a protein that turned out to be a tumor suppressor in neuroblastoma, which means that when that protein is present during embryogenesis, which it is normally, it suppresses tumor. It suppresses neuroblastoma hinders neuroblastoma to develop. But when that protein is lost, and we've seen that that is because of a chromosomal aberration, so it's not mutations, but it seemed to be a chromosomal aberration. We haven't been able to show exactly how. Then neuroblastoma can develop. So we've looked at this in many different aspects, and now also during development that we are about to publish the papers in revision. But I'm very proud of that, because it was a protein that I had no interest in because I didn't know it existed. So when I did my postdoc, I worked on this other protein that we still work on, and I needed some markers, which meant that to be able to study my other protein, I got a list from a postdoc colleague in the lab in the US who said, well, you can use these markers. We just, you know, they hadn't even published a paper yet, but they've done some experiments to show, well, these proteins or these genes are regulated. You can use these as sort of markers or an indication of what happens when you manipulate your other protein. So I did, and this protein, everything behaved as you expected, all the other genes, but this gene was just crazy. And my first thought was, of course, to just skip it. Never mind. But it sort of still caught my interest, like, why does it behave like this? So it was a serendipity, and then I said, well, let's just try an experiment. Let's just do an in vivo experiment and see if something happens with this. So we did, and we encountered some problems. We had mycoplasma infection in the animal facility. And then we said, well, okay, one last experiment. I couldn't really let it go. So one last experiment, and then we'll let it go. And it turned out it had a huge impact on tumor growth. And this was, I mean, seven years ago. And I had a student in the lab. She's still my PhD student. She's soon defending her thesis. She started as a student. And I said, well, you know, I have this project that I have been working on as a postdoc. I have all of these results. It looks really cool. So you can work on that, and we'll probably publish next year. 5 years later, we published, as always is the case with research. But going from that very, you know, discovery of serendipity of a protein that I, maybe a reasonable person or any other, well, a scientist would, but people that are not scientists that are reasonable would probably say, you know, let's just skip it, or like, you know, just let it go because it's just, you know. But as scientists, I think that's one of our strengths, that we are adaptable and we can sort of see that we are curious. You know, I was so curious about this protein. What, you know, what happened? Why is it like this? And I'm so proud of not letting it go, at least, you know, give it a small chance, or giving it a chance of maybe showing something. And it turned out when we did all, and then of course we did so much more work and used all different kind of model organisms, and this other paper that's in revision.
And also the eggs.
Yes, exactly. And the paper that we have continued on, that's completely in chicken embryos, because then we look at completely how this protein works during development. And we can actually see that when it's lost, because we take it away in the chicken embryo, and we can see that we, you know, the organs doesn't develop as they should. And we have some kind of a neuroblastoma lesion. So I think that, and together with the result that we published last year, that we saw that it's a tumor suppressor in neuroblastoma. And now, first of all, I'm kind of proud of that, showing that this is a completely new protein. It's only in about 5% of the patients. So, I mean, it doesn't explain all neuroblastomas. There will never be an explanation to all neuroblastomas. But this subset of neuroblastoma, and they are really, really at high risk. These patients have a really low survival. It's less than 20% that survive if they have this aberration. So we've identified this really, really high risk group, and now we've been able, and what I'm really proud of is showing that, but also now connecting it to the developmental part. And we did that in the paper, and then the reviewers said, Your paper is always scrutinized by peers in the field. And for the first and probably only time ever during my career, we got that you have too much data in your paper, which will probably never happen again. They usually ask for more data. But they said, well, it's difficult when it's both development and cancer. And my opinion is still that, well, you know, the connection is obvious, and if we look at it together, but you know, it seemed to be too complicated still for the field. And we had too much data, so we published on the cancer part, and now we're publishing the development, so we had to separate the two into two papers. But I'm really happy about the connections that we are able to do now. And that has been my aim and goal since I started. And now we've actually been able to do that. This is just a small step, right? But this is what I want to do. This is the connection between these two parts and actually understand what can happen during development. And with the chick embryo, we actually now have the possibility. We've developed this method that was not present before because people have only used it to study really early developmental time points. And now we actually keep the embryos almost until hatching, not really, but all like not too far away. And all the organs have developed and no one's ever done that before. It's a lot of work. We get very few embryos, but we have done that, and we can actually look at how organs develop from when we manipulate something really, really early, and then to when the organs are fully developed. So I'm being able to connect that and having set up this model where we can do that is something that I'm really sort of proud and happy about because we've actually found something of, in my opinion, importance.
Yeah, it's just too bad that it's not a human.
Yes. Yeah, of course. Yeah. We do get human embryo material. It's scarce. It gets more and more rare because of the way that we perform abortions today, because these embryos that we get are from elected abortions, and then the women are asked to donate the embryo and some say yes. The thing is today, which is fantastic for these women, is that the method of abortion, so to say, is much better for the woman, but it also destroys the embryo, so it cannot be used for research. So we get fewer and fewer embryos, but we do get material every once in a while. So we have been able, but of course we cannot grow them. Of course, they are not alive. So what we do is we can use the material from them. And that we've done to compare how the same cells look in the chicken embryo and the human embryo. And again, we can only do that up to a certain time point because the human embryo we can only get up till 12 weeks. After that, we cannot get embryo material, of course, or fetal material. But what we've seen is that these proteins that we are working on, they are really similar. So again, I'm definitely not saying that what we show in the chicken embryo is 100% true for the human setting, because we cannot do that. But I do think that we are showing something very similar, and we do relate it to the clinical parameters we have and patient material and tissue from patients and DNA and RNA data from patients. So again, we can never show that what functionally happens in the chick is happening in the human, but I do think we get a lot of clues, as do people that work on mice, for example, and other models. We always have the limitation. It's not human. But so far, we cannot study it in humans, so we have to sort of settle with this and try to do whatever we can to show that what we find in the chicken embryo or the mouse or the zebrafish is relating to the human, or that we can use the knowledge in a safe way. And always keeping in mind that it is a limitation.
Oddajo je pripravila Dora.
Ja, RS Interview.